the terrorist attacks, especially in the provinces of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan. In the year 2022 alone, more than 150 attacks were carried out by the outfit, mainly against the defense forces, resulting in more than 150 deaths. The present economic and political turmoil has been regarded as one of the reasons of this resurgence.
Since withdrawing from the ceasefire signed between the government of Pakistan and the TTP, the Tehreek Taliban Pakistan has been responsible for more than 100 attacks in the last 1 year. The outfit has intensified its attack on the Pakistani army and police since November 2022. There is a looming threat of rise in the violence in the coming months, and according to the security experts, 2023 may prove to be a bloody year. The defense analysts link this terrorism surge to the worst economic crisis and political instability that Pakistan is facing. Issuing warning to the Pakistani armed forces carrying out operations against its fighters in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, the Pakistani Taliban has threatened of targeting the security forces throughout the country.
Such big incidents always galvanize every strata of the society. So the people, government, intelligence agencies, army, they all normally come on the same page when such a huge attack takes place. So, but the problem is this coming together on one page that does not survive for a very, very long time, as we saw in the case of APS attack. When the APS attack happened, immediately after that, an operation was launched and the entire area was cleared of Tehreek-e-Taliban. I mean, it was a very, very bloody fight, but the success was achieved. Now, the problem is the last Pakistani COS, his legacy is, sorry to say, very, very poor in all regards, in the way he has interfered in the politics of Pakistan, the way he has squandered whatever achievements which his predecessors had done vis-a-vis TTP in the tribal belts. So now what is happening is that once again, every a part of the country, which means every stakeholder, army, intelligence agencies, people, government, they appear to be on the same page as of now. And this would always mean that there would be an operation to eradicate them.
Pakistan has been battling with terrorist attacks since the past 2 decades. However, the intensity has increased in the last 3 months, with the Tehreek Taliban Pakistan breaking the Afghan Taliban arranged ceasefire accord between the Pakistani government and the Taliban fighters. In one of the deadliest attacks since 2018, on 4th March 2020, the Islamic State Khorasan province attacked in Peshawar in March last year, resulting in the death of 64 people. The latest violence has raised the horror alarm amongst the residents of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, fearing a military operation in the tribal areas.
Militant agencies all over the world, they do give threats. The only difference is in the case of TTP, we must take it very seriously. Because every time they have given a threat, they have managed to sort of create some incident or the other, which is very, very spectacular. Because that is what they want. They want a spectacular incident to happen so that it will sort of boost their image among the population, which is attracted toward this special Deobandi-influenced jihad. So what is happening is that to achieve that, they go out of the way. Now, what is problematic is that because of the deeply entrenched Deobandi ideology inside the general population of Pakistan, it is very easy for TTP to find sympathizers from not only within the governments but also within the security agencies and intelligence agencies and army and everybody, because the people of Deobandi ideology make a large portion of population in Pakistan. So the problem is the ease with which they infiltrate the government machinery. This is very, very problematic. So their threat should never be taken as an idle threat. Their threat, most of the time, is followed by a bite. So I guess that this threat would be taken seriously in Islamabad, and I think the security agencies, army, and the civilian government will be on the same page to deal very, very strongly with this organization.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Leaving a controversial legacy behind, Pakistan's former president Parvez Musharraf died at the age of 79. The four-star general who seized power after a 1999 military coup was known as a key US ally against the Al-Qaeda in South Asia. The response to his death in Pakistan was muted, with many senior figures refraining from commenting on his complex legacy out of respect. Shahbaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, whose brother Nawaz Sharif was overthrown and imprisoned by Musharraf, tweeted offering condolences to the family of the former general.
Musharraf was born in a lower middle class family in Delhi that moved to Karachi after the partition of 1947. Securing a place in Pakistani army, he quickly rose through the ranks and became Pakistan's top military general, leading a bloodless coup against the Nawaz Sharif's government in 1999. After the 9/11 attacks, Musharraf became known for his close alliance with the U.S. on its war on terror. He was once described by the former U.S. President George W. Bush as a courageous leader and a friend of the United States. His decision to align with the U.S. contradicted Pakistan's long-standing support for the Taliban, who controlled Afghanistan during that period. Proving to be damaging for Pakistan, the decision made Musharraf a target for domestic militant groups. His support to the U.S. invasion proved deeply unpopular, as it led to heavy civilian casualties, resulting in a deep anti-Western sentiment throughout the country. However, it seems that Pakistan had no other choice. In the words of Musharraf, the Bush administration had threatened to bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age had the country not cooperated with America's war on Afghanistan.
For some, the ex-military ruler of Pakistan was an able administrator, a person with a modern outlook who was credited with attracting foreign investment. He garnered the support of the military and Pakistanis who backed his crackdown against the militant groups. While many condoled the demise of the main architect of Kargil War, others questioned his legacy, believing that he failed to build on his early popularity of promoting sustainable economic and political reforms. He turned into a captive of military power and vested interests.
In February 1999, just weeks after the then Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee visited Lahore on the invitation of Sharif to try to make a breakthrough in bilateral relations by signing the Lahore Declaration, Pakistani troops disguised as irregular fighters secretly infiltrated the line of control in the Kargil sector. It triggered a brief but fierce border conflict that ended disastrously for the Pakistani side. While Musharraf claimed that the ceasefire in Kargil was a military triumph, others in Pakistan considered it one of the biggest tragic blunders in Pakistan's history. Kargil War was responsible for the first confrontation of two atomic powers, resulting in the increase in tensions between India and Pakistan. Another consequence of Kargil War was the refusal of the U.S. to reward Pakistan for its aggression. America insisted on Pakistan's withdrawal to the line of control. This led to an immediate and positive impact on the Indo-US relations and changed the geopolitics of the region. Pakistan was heavily criticized by many countries for instigating the war. Even China, a longtime friend of Pakistan, insisted on a pullout of forces along the LOC. On the other hand, India was praised internationally for its restraint, resulting in further weakening the position of Pakistan.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Munir Ahmad from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Mr. Ahmad, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Parvez Musharraf was a general who took power with a coup and was forced into exile later. So the question is, what lesson has his life given to the people and the governments in the region?
Certainly, yes. There are many lessons to learn from General Musharraf's era and from him as well. He was the dictator, as everyone knows, and he toppled the democratic government. First of all, majority of the country did not accept him as a ruler, because everyone in Pakistan, the general public, has been like frustrated about the dictatorship, and the military corporates that are run in Pakistan. And the second lessons that is to be learned from that was this sort of democratic process he launched. Mostly, they were all the third-rate, mostly the third-rate politicians he collected around him, and those who call like always go for vested interest. And they were not the politicians, but the rejected people of in the politics of Pakistan. And then, and what the regime they developed in Pakistan, the I'm talking about the political regime, and that was not acceptable to most of the people. And thirdly, the you know, allegations of corruption against the politicians and arrests on some so-called corruption cases was also not liked by the people, and it was merely called a political victimization.
Mr. Ahmad, so for many Pakistanis, Musharraf left behind a grim legacy. Is his legacy still having an impact on the country?
His legacy is no more, I believe. But the elements he promoted in Pakistan still exist. Even when the establishment has to oust the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from the government, he launched Imran Khan, who was already a power monger and power hungry at that time. And he could not have been getting much popularity in the political arena. So establishment took him as their main horse, and they collected all those rejected pieces again around him. And those the promoted one are still in the politics of Pakistan and in the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. And they are around with Imran Khan. So I think they still exist in the politics, but as far as we say, like the legacy of Parvez Musharraf in terms of its own political party, that does not exist. But the elements of his party has joined mostly PTI or have been silent for some time.
Mr. Ahmad, the Kargil War can be considered as one of the most important events during Musharraf's tenure. What lasting effect did the war have on Pakistan?
Kargil War, I must not say that it as a war, but that misadventure of General Musharraf has so many implications for Pakistan's diplomacy and friendly, the efforts to have friendly ties with India. And also, like, it has created chaos among the ranks of the establishment, army, and the politicians. That the misadventure that led to, you know, more bitter relationship with India. And also, Pakistan sacrificed so many lives of the soldiers over there. And still, we feel that we cannot cope up with the damage that Kargil war did to Pakistan, to its society, and its to bilateral relations with India. And we still feel that Pakistan and India shall have friendly bilateral ties, so that because half of the families live in India and half of the families live in Pakistan, and they have been living for decades or so. And if there are a certain bitterness between the two countries, the visa regimes are stopped, so no visas for the families to go and come to Pakistan. So, and this is really a tyranny for the families and their relationships.
Before we let you go, sir, some experts believe that instead of supporting the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, Musharraf could have negotiated and drawn a red line to maximize Pakistan's strategic interests. What is your opinion on this?
Pakistan's decision to go to go with America for the war with Afghanistan, or in Afghanistan, or attacking Afghanistan, was certainly could have been negotiated, and for more strategic benefits. Whatever we earn of the friendship or the strategic mileage before. In the previous two decades before going to war on terrorism, was lost during the war on terrorism. And we also lost more than 80,000 of soldiers and civilians in Pakistan, in the Fatah areas and on the borders adjacent to Afghanistan. So that was the major loss. We also had a very collateral damage of billions of rupees in those areas where the Pakistan army was fighting against the terrorists. And the third loss was Pakistan had very bitter and bitter relationship with Taliban. Though Taliban was not created by Pakistan, but that was the offshoot of the Mujahideen or the previous war or like jihad against the Russian invasion, quote unquote, in Afghanistan. But if there had been a democratic government or the civilian government, certainly this matter would have been discussed in the parliament. And I believe the Musharraf's coup was to go for such kind of initiative.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Munir Ahmad from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Adil Ali said in his Twitter, "Revenge of injustice with those who make history is always taken by the time itself. Parviz Musharraf tend to be a godfather at his time of power. His leftovers banned the court which punished former dictator, but today all of them are helpless and he's facing revenge of time." Zaytung said, "Parviz Musharraf started a war inside Pakistan on behalf of then ally USA, and now even after his death our armed forces are facing casualties in war that wasn't ours and wasn't needed to be fought. None of the terrorists fighting Pakistan today were anti-Pakistan before that." Adil Raja said in his tweet, "Death of a dictator forced out of power by his own. Stark reminder for those seeking artificial political legitimacy for their puppet rulers." Muazzam Beg described Musharraf in this way, "The man who had me abducted from Pakistan in front of my kids in 2002 and boasted about CIA bounty cash he earned selling hundreds of Muslims to be held without charge and tortured in Guantanamo and secret prisons is dead."
And that was our episode about the legacy of Parviz Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan who died at the age of 79 after years in exile. And also the recent suicide bombing in Peshawar, which killed more than 100 people. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
خدایی که مدبر الامور به من و شما با این آیه 96 سوره اعراف میگه
In Surah Al-A'raf ayah 96 we read If the people of the towns had been faithful and God-wary we would have opened to them blessings from the heaven and the earth but they denied so we seized them because of what they used to earn Allah, through this ayah, is stating that the sole administrator of the affairs is Himself. Allah wants to notice the fact that all the people prove His power of creating the world with all its beauties, and if they stay faithful, blessings will be poured on them.
شما هیچ دو تا سبزی تو عالم پیدا نمی‌کنید عین هم باشه.
One good example of the power of Allah is the creation of the plants and trees. Although they are green, no two colors are the same. Even the tiniest fishes at the bottom of the oceans are colored very beautifully, that no human painter is capable to recreate them. Thus, Allah wants the people to believe in Him faithfully as they have believed in His power of creation and do not replace Him with any other power. Thus, the people are invited to refer to Allah in His book, the Holy Quran. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The enthusiasm of the Iranian people to protect the achievements of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic as the model system of government for all aspiring societies is another smashing blow on the face of global arrogance and its mercenaries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard on Saturday, February 11th, multimillion-strong rallies once again brightened up the face of Iran as the masses in some 1,400 towns and cities and 38,000 villages and hamlets marked 44th anniversary of the triumph of the grassroots Islamic movement that threw into the dustbin of history the ruthless Pahlavi potentate and the puppeteers in London and Washington who controlled him. People of all ages, ranging from infants in prams to the elders, jubilantly celebrated the independence of Iran and the life breathed into the nation by Imam Khomeini, the restoration of honor and dignity to Iranian women, and the liberties achieved by all sections of the society. In Tehran, the masses converged on Azadi Square from different directions of the capital to listen to the speech of Iranian President Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi amidst vociferous chants of God's Majesty, Allahu Akbar, and renewal of allegiance to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was a spectacular sight to see the unity of the Iranian people, who unanimously denounced the great Satan, the U.S., and its devilish imp, the Zionist regime, while making a bonfire of the flags of these two arch-enemies of humanity. The yardstick of progress of a nation are its achievements in both the spiritual and material fields, including science and technology, and promotion of religious cultural values, such as ethics, public morals, and the dignity of hijab for women. Over the past 44 years, despite the intensity of the plots of its enemies, the Islamic Republic has achieved self-sufficiency in almost all fields. True to the principles of the revolution, it has never hesitated to help nations and people in distress, whether those affected by natural disasters, including earthquakes, floods, famines, and epidemics, or terrorized by the clients of big powers through wars, bloodshed, and sanctions. This is the reason people in various parts of the world, such as the West, Southern and Central Asia, as well as Africa and parts of the Americas, have joined the Iranian people in celebrating the anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. For instance, the way the Muslim people of Nigeria held road rallies in Abuja and Kano, and the people of Iraq and Lebanon held gatherings to pay homage to the ideals of the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, was a treat to watch. Meanwhile, Crescent International Road, given the brutal sanctions to which Islamic Iran has been subjected for decades, visitors to the country are surprised to find the massive construction cranes that dot Tehran's skyline, new highways snake through the capital city to keep up with demand of ever-increasing numbers of cars. The same situation is noticeable in other cities. This is one aspect of the rate of progress in Iran. The other more impressive is the growth in knowledge-based companies and the startups in Iran. UNESCO's Science Report 2021 states there has been exponential growth in knowledge-based firms and startups in Iran. This trend is the result of heightened domestic demand combined with the multiplication of technology incubators and accelerators since the launch of the country's first public innovation centers in 2015. UNESCO's report further states by 2020, 49 innovation accelerators had been established with private equity and 113 innovation centers had been set up in partnership with science parks and major universities. Technology incubators, meanwhile, have been providing graduate entrepreneurs with co-working spaces and mentoring on campus to help them launch their own startup. The government has been encouraging startups to diversify into knowledge-based fields. A series of laws and policies adopted since 2015 have removed barriers to competition and enhanced the financial support system for innovation. Between 2014 and 2017, exports of knowledge-based goods grew by a factor of 5, that is 500%, according to UNESCO's report. When Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal in May 2018, and reimposed illegal sanctions, Iran's economy came under great pressure. In 2021, Iran raised its science and technology exports to $1 billion in 70 countries. In some global markets, Iranian companies have overtaken European and American companies. Siavash Maliki, deputy head of the Innovation and Prosperity Fund, was quoted by the Tehran Times as saying, "The number of knowledge-based Iranian companies now exceeds 6,800. With half active in the field of electronics and electricity. It needs recalling that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, designates each Iranian year starting in March for some special objective. The year March 2022 to March 2023 has been designated as the year of production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. Not surprisingly, Iranian scientists and engineers have focused on this area with spectacular results. Iran is also a leader in nanotechnology and aerospace in the West Asia region. Hitherto, its exports went mainly to Iraq, Afghanistan, Russia, and Syria. The new destinations for Iran's science and technology exports will include The Persian Gulf literally states Europe, China, and Central Asia. Given its huge resource base, Iran has the world's fourth largest number of engineering graduates, with some 5 million engineers. It provides a solid base to build a knowledge-based economy. In matters of defense, Iran has become virtually self-sufficient. It has also made impressive gains in missile and drone technology. Not surprisingly, both are being targeted by the collective West and their illegitimate offspring, Zionist Israel. Even Tehran's staunch enemies now admit that Iran has made impressive gains in missile and drone technology. Addressing the International Congress for Women of Influence in Tehran on January 19, 2023, President Seyed Ebrahim Raisi pointed out that women had made great progress since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February 1979. He elaborated on the significant measures Iran has taken to improve the situation of women. Pointing to the empowerment of women, President Raisi said they had improved their status in scientific, cultural, social, and economic arenas, while observing their human dignity. Women constitute more than 30% of university lecturers in Iran, and close to 60% of university students in the country are women. The path to progress is not found in degradation, but through dignified existence that allows women to lead a life without being molested by men. This is an important lesson that the collective West refuses to learn.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Well, Professor Naqavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Well, Professor, today we have another question, and again from a teen. The question is, I'm a girl and I am 17 years old. I wish to wake up early and offer Fajr prayers, but unfortunately I often miss my prayers. First, I used to feel guilty, but since it became so often, it does not affect me much now. And I am concerned about this. Can you help me understand if something is wrong within me? And is there anything or any way that I can wake up on time and offer Salat on time?
Yes, it's a problem which many youth face. Even elder people may face, because if one has not become comes into the habit of sleeping on time and waking up on time, and that of course has to be inculcated at a very early age. That habit forming takes place if parents are sleeping on time, going to bed on time, and waking up early in the morning. That habit may be,
transmitted to the
children. Or even if they remain awake, their children should be made to go to sleep. But again, generally what happens is the children are forced to go to sleep. It does not become a habit. The moment they come to high school or college or university, they gain a little type of freedom. They forget that. But basically, when we are going to sleep, some things are, they are carried out properly. I mean, you can, sometimes we go off to sleep when we're tired and we become exhausted, and we just put our heads on the pillow and we're off to sleep. That's not the way to go to sleep. There are special protocols to be followed before going to sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to change your dress, you need to brush your teeth, you need to go to the washroom, you need to, take all these, going to sleep.
And when you do this step-by-step process, your brain also gets some message that something is going to happen. It starts actually sleeping.
Actually, it's a project and it's in its own right. It's something which you have to manage as a behavior, as a very behavior which has with intention and purpose. You're preparing yourself for an event. Going off to sleep sleeping is a form of death. You're going off to the other world,
yeah.
And God will bring you back in the morning. So everything is related to this understanding of sleep and death that we as Muslims have. So you're preparing for a very beautiful journey. So you need to prepare yourself, even carry out wudu ablution, because it is said that if you go to sleep with ablution, it's like you are worshipping and praying all night.
And there
are certain prayers that have to be recited. Then the holy verse of the Surah Kahf, I think the last verse is recited, and it's very influential in waking you up in the morning. And you go to sleep and intend to get up and make a conviction and make a condition for yourself that you shall wake up at this time. You sit and you make a purposeful decision to wake up at maybe 5 o'clock in the morning or maybe 6 o'clock in the morning in time for prayers. And then if you have a difficulty in that, then use an alarm clock. If you have a difficulty in that, then ask an elder person to wake you up.
You can ask someone to come.
So it's preparing. I mean, you feel that you're preparing for an event. Recite the tasbih of Hazrat Zahra. I mean, we know.
It's as good as if you perform Umrah and Hajj, as it's recommended by Prophet, peace be upon him, to his daughter. Well, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the teens who have problem in waking up on time, and professors are helping us what conditions to follow, what things to do, so that one can wake up on time.
So all the time, it's if we want to make purposeful decisions to carry out habit forming and habit changing, we need to employ PDCA, as we mentioned before, plan to do something, do it, check if you've done properly, So it's a continuous struggle.
Yeah.
It's you should not let up at all. You should continuously try. I mean, try again. You may not be able to wake up one day, 2 days, 3 days, but if you're planning on it, if you're making a purposeful decision and conditioning yourself and trying to imbibe in yourself and make yourself realize that I have to do this, I have to wake up, I need to wake up with energy, I need to wake up. And especially your eating habits also are important. If you go to sleep with a full stomach, then that's a problem. You need to have a lighter dinner maybe, or an early dinner. You have an early supper and go to bed after a few hours of having your dinner, your supper. Then you have a lighter stomach. And that is again very important in when going off to sleep. And sleep, again, I think it's psychologically mentioned for there's a certain sleep cycle which has to be taken care of. And the hours before midnight which you sleep are twofold.
All right.
It's mentioned that the hours which you sleep before midnight have a two times more effect than the hours which you sleep after
the midnight.
And that deep sleep which you need, where you go off to start dreaming, it should not be in the early mornings. It should be early in the middle of the night.
Exactly. So because if you go to sleep at some 9 or 10 p.m., you go to deep sleep at 12. That's what the psychologists say, that the deep sleep should be at the midnight,
unfortunately,
not towards the morning.
Habits, the society in societies where they turn off the marketplaces. Even in the West, we have many countries where markets close at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. In the East, unfortunately, markets remain open till 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. So that's the difficult. We don't take care of the
health.
Energy.
Health.
Energy, health, everything's jeopardized. So we need to manage our lives in a way. I mean, you don't need
there
to
there should be a proper timetable.
Timetable, not necessarily have to three meals a day. Two meals a day, you can survive with 2 meals a day. Morning heavy meals and early suppers or dinners. And in between you can have refreshments. So, I mean, we need to change our lifestyle. Habits have to be changed. Going to early sleep. Unfortunately, the television is also the television programs. They continued late into the night, so that has to change. We should change our habits before going to sleep. We offer if we are not able to wake up, 2 rakats of hajj, and go to sleep with this 2 rakats of hajj that Allah Almighty gives me the
capability
to wake up in the morning. So inshallah it will affect.
Indeed, Allah does, because he says, if you come towards me 1 step, I will come 10. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nagafi, and we are discussing a very important issue by a 17-year-old girl. Shared with us that she says she's not able to wake up on time, and Professor helped us with so many suggestions, what to do, what to follow, so that she can wake up in time. Professor, one part of her question is remaining, wherein she said that before, when she could not wake up for Fajr, she used to feel guilty about it. Why my Salat has missed. But now it has become so often that she is now used to it. Is there something wrong with her conscience?
We should feel, of course, maybe you could say if you're not able to wake up, then God will not punish you. But still, it reflects the inner soul, the condition of our soul inside us. it does not have a pure nature then. If we're not distressed.
But that's what she wanted to know. So the nature of the soul has changed somewhere. She has to look upon it.
She has to go back to it. She should be able to
analyze
it, what's happening within her. Maybe the food she's taking or whatever, some of her actions are influencing that. So there has to be a reflection within herself about herself. She should be distressed. She should feel bad and guilty about it. And moreover, if one could practice the habit of, again, muhasabah before going to sleep, reflecting upon what have we achieved from till the morning till the night, and plan for tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
We should go to sleep with a plan that tomorrow I'm going to wake up at this time, pray, have go for exercise, have breakfast, go to work, go to sleep, to work or for studies or whatever. If I have a plan in my mind and I'm to follow that plan, I need my body to adapt to that cycle and to become a habit, and my body automatically follows what I need to do. So I think we need to have a plan for each and every hour. Allah Almighty says in the hereafter, a small particle will be, evaluated. A particle. وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَهُ وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ شَرًّا يَرَهُ.
That you can't even imagine. Every minor detail.
That is for the hereafter. But that tells us how to manage things in this world. In microseconds.
How careful to be.
We should, the basic resource, the most valuable resource which we have at our disposal is time. How we manage this time is important. So sleeping on time, waking up on time, doing things on time, that's the essence of a successful life. And the pure life, hayat tayyiba, can be ensured if we take care of these things.
Yes, thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. So, dear sister, what Professor said so far is that he gave you so many suggestions how you can wake up on time. And the next, another part of your question was that, is there something wrong with your conscience? Professor said, unfortunately, yes, you got to look at it. But this thing in itself that you're questioning us and you're making of words and you want to know, shows somewhere that her conscience is somewhere alive and it has to be, it's not gone that down the track and it could be mended. Well, thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and for sharing such beautiful messages with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, any queries, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, COI, Call of Islam, wherein you can find this program, our previous programs, and with all the subtopics that are written in the titles. You can also find us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.